Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. Pim, why don't you bring in the esteemed economist from Citigroup?
Oh, yes. And in fact, I have to say, I was just watching you speak with Catherine Mann, Citigroup's global chief economist, while you were on television. Catherine Mann, it's always a pleasure. Thanks very much for being here. Can you explain what the real relationship is between the performance of the U.S. economy and the performance of the U.S. stock market?
Well, actually, the two of them make sense right now. I mean, the U.S. economy is doing extremely well. I mean, the unemployment rate is quite low. There's a tax cut. Profits are high. Growth is strong. It makes perfect sense that stocks should be very elevated. Now, you got to ask the question, though. We knew that growth was going to be really strong, and we knew that unemployment was going to be really low, and we knew everybody was going to get a tax cut. So maybe it's a little overdone.
When you say overdone, meaning the exuberance, the enthusiasm to buy stocks?
Well, I think that there's quite a bit of enthusiasm. A lot of people are buying stocks. And you got to ask, what is the new information that is being incorporated in the stock valuations that we have today? I think that's really the question, because I'm not sure there's much new information that would warrant this much exuberance.
Well, how about new information that looks at the U.S. stock market relative to what's happening in the rest of the world, whether it be Turkey or China or continental Europe and Brexit, or indeed even Brazil and Argentina? And as a result, you take a second look and you think that decision to sell U.S. equities and go someplace else is a decision that you're not going to make right now.
Well, again, I mean, my view is that there are a lot of emerging markets that actually are very good opportunities. And all of the emerging markets are sort of being tarred with the same brush and looking, there are some definite places that you do not want to invest, but there are a lot that where you do want to invest. They do represent opportunities. And so
Where would you be booking a ticket to go and check out the companies?
Indonesia, Malaysia. I would also look at some Latin countries, Peru, Chile, Colombia. These are countries that we don't hear about a whole lot, but in fact, they have been extremely disciplined in terms of their policies, and they represent good opportunities. Now, you got to wonder about the neighborhood. We always have to wonder about the neighborhood, whether it be Asia or whether it be Latin America or Europe, but, there are good opportunities.
This is a really important insight because, as you say, nobody focuses on Peru except I had a wonderful conversation with the president of Peru 2 years ago about that distinction of Peru. This goes back to Douglas
Kuczynski. Was that Pierre Pablo Kuczynski?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This goes back to Douglas North at Washington University in St. Louis about the strength and need of institutions. Mm-hmm. And really what we're really talking about in this debate is country A doesn't have the institutional structure, leadership, and governance, and a country really can be adjacent, can be fine. I mean, it's really what we're talking about in all this, isn't it?
Well, as I say, I think the neighborhood does matter. I mean, there's no question that if you're surrounded by a challenging environment, you're not going to do as well as a situation where you have the opportunity to trade with your neighbors, and that's beneficial for both. So you do care about the neighborhood, but on the other hand, getting back to the choices that investors have to make, which place are you going to get more value, the S&P or on a more disaggregated basis, individual companies, maybe some companies that we don't hear about so much in the United States, and some companies in countries that we don't hear about so much. So we talk about activist versus pacifist investing. This is a time to be an activist investor and really, do your homework and do your analysis and figure out what the good deals are.
Point taken. And I'm wondering whether when you speak about countries such as Peru and Chile and Colombia, are you talking about commodity-driven economies?
Well, Peru's not, well, Peru does have commodities. So there are commodity elements to it for sure. But these are countries that actually have been able to diversify. They also have been able, as I say, have disciplined policies. And that is something that that has been important for the stabilization of those economies and to put them on a growth path.
And to have the actual determination and I would say conviction to stay in if indeed there are any short-term declines in the value of these companies or assets that you describe because of the mistakes or the headline reading that goes on around them to take advantage of those opportunities.
Yeah.
That means you've got to have the same kind of wherewithal, let's say, with the United States. If stocks were to decline, do you see any possibility that we're going to have a correction in asset values?
Well, I think there, you know, as we think about the sort of the pathway that the Federal Reserve is on, which is to, in a measured pace, increase interest rates, increase the policy rate, you know, we have to think about what does the, you know, that do for other financial assets. And I think there's a question as to whether or not if we get another, you know, 75 basis points, what does the financial market look like at that point?
Robert Engel, the laureate of NYU, talks about Garch and hugely fancy econometrics. But what it comes down to is at some point the system seizes up. You know, Pim talks about asset prices and the fear that they'll go down. What do you observe in hindsight that we should watch to determine if the system seizes up? Is it just simply foreign exchange? Is the global litmus paper? Or do you have to look at short-term paper, full faith and credit, 2 years? What's the thing you watch every day on your four Bloomberg terminals at your desk?
I do look at quite a variety of things. But what I look at it right now is I'm looking at what I see are a variety of risks across asset prices that seem to be a little bit underpriced. Let's talk about credit risk, for example. When you can have a high yield bond or a covenant light loan and you're paying very, very little for it, you're figuring out at some point that that's going to go bad. We can also look, again, I think that the stock market is an interesting animal. I mean, we all know that financial markets do herd. And, you know, again, I have to ask the question, what is the new news that warrants the degree of exuberance that is in the market today?
Well, I want to not get to the whole question because we're going to come back and spend more time with you, Catherine. But if people are buying at the short end of the curve, right, that everyone's talking short end, short end, short end. Why is the curve so flat? Does that make sense to you? I mean, wouldn't prices just increase and increase?
Well, there are, this is, we spend many hours and talk with many people about this question, about what's going on with the 10-year yield, that being an important factor, important anchor to many financial decisions. And we can go through a number of different arguments for what's going on with it. But, you know, there are issues about the flows into 10-year long duration bonds that come from other countries who currently have very low interest rates on their sovereign obligations, sovereign debt. And so if sovereigns is really what you want, then the U.S. is really your best.
That's the only way.
Your best.
Thank you. Catherine Mann, thank you so much. A wide discussion today with the chief global economist for Citigroup, Catherine Mann.
Let's talk about what's going on in politics for just a second.
Or in the budget.
Budget as well. Stan Collender, of course, he's an executive vice president and national director of financial communications for MSL Group in the United States. And Stan Collender, it's always a pleasure to hear what you've got to say about what's going on in Washington. My question is, how long do you believe Attorney General Jeff Sessions is going to have that job?
Let's see. Election day is November 6th, so maybe the 7th.
Really? That's what's going to happen?
Well, look, it's not like Donald Trump calls me and tells me what his plans are, but it looks as if he's been lobbying, and the reports are that he's been lobbying the Democrat and Republican senators to say, I want to get rid of this guy, and you've got to let me do it. So right after the
election— But why can't he do it? What is it? He doesn't need their approval.
No, he doesn't need their approval, but he does need them to confirm a replacement, number one. Number two, he doesn't want to do it before the elections where it might have some impact on the voting. And three, he wants the Mueller probe to move a little bit further along so it doesn't look like he's trying to obstruct justice. It doesn't make any sense for him to do it before the election, and all the reporting is that right afterwards. Look, it wouldn't be surprising if 2 years after an election, the president replaces many people in his cabinet. The difference is that in this case, a lot of people have been replaced already.
Stan, you've got in one of your notes an alarming observation for at least for me. You put a chance of a government shutdown at 60%. I just didn't know that.
Well, normally you would say in a situation like that, like we're in now, that it would be a very low possibility. That is, the Republicans in the majority in both houses don't want it because it'll keep them in Washington and unable to go home and campaign and hold fundraisers. That they need to campaign because, especially in the House, because there may be a Democratic wave or a Democratic takeover. But that same situation is what gives Donald Trump the ability. It gives him additional leverage to get money for his wall. That is, if the Republicans want to go home and he has the ability to keep them here, he has some leverage to say, give me the money for the wall, you're not going anywhere. Also, Trump may need to use the wall and the impact on the immigration issue to help him with his voters, his base, which is particularly important because of all the other legal stuff going on.
I saw this tweet, and I'm sorry, Pim, I wasn't sure if it was from Donald J. Trump or Stanley Colander. Here it is. Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner had nothing to do with the so-called pushing out of Don McGahn. The fake news media has it purposely so wrong. They love to portray chaos in the White House when they know that chaos doesn't exist. And this is Colander, classic, quote, just a smooth running machine with changing parts. Is that our budget process, Stan, in Washington?
All right. First of all, I did not write that tweet.
Oh, you didn't?
Yeah, no, no. Second, did you see the news this morning, Tom and Pim, that another member of the White House counsel's office who handles their ethics investigations is leaving Friday? That is tomorrow.
Yeah.
So, there is nothing here that's going on in the White House that's smooth. But, Tom, you've got to say the budget process, to the extent that there is one, is even worse. That is, there is no process. There was no budget resolution this year. We're way behind on all the appropriations. There's only 11 legislative days before the start of the fiscal year, and nothing has been enacted. Nothing's even been sent to the White House for evaluation. So,
doesn't the majority have the power to do that?
Oh, absolutely. Budget resolutions cannot be filibustered. But the reason they didn't do it this year is that they didn't want to take votes on trillion-dollar deficits before the election. So, I mean, it's legally required to do a budget, but they just there's no enforcement if Congress doesn't want to do it themselves. And the Democrats could filibuster appropriations in the Senate, so the majority, the Republicans, don't have full control. But has anyone heard the word compromise recently in Washington? Probably not. That could get these bills done. If they had committed to them months ago, they could have got them done by the start of the fiscal year and taken away any chance of a government shutdown.
Stan Colander, midterm elections. Handicap them for us.
Well, look, I am not the elections forecaster that several other people are, but from the people I trust and I go to for advice and information, it looks as if the Democrats, as of today, will take over the House by maybe 20 seat margin. That's not enough to get anything done next year, but it's enough to stop a lot of things from happening. The Senate seems a little bit more problematic for the Democrats. Only because the map is so difficult that the Republicans might even gain a couple of seats while the Democrats take over the House. But look, we're only, 2 months away from the election, and anything could happen, especially given the craziness of the president a little bit. We just don't know where things are going.
The popularity of the president connected to the strength of the U.S. economy, in your thought?
Only to a certain extent. Obviously, if the economy were not doing as well as it's doing, the president's popularity would probably be down 5 points or so. But let's go back to something he said during the campaign. He could shoot somebody in Times Square and his base would still stay with him. I think you find the same thing here. That is that the economy is not the only issue. It's abortion. It's immigration. It's this MAGA feeling, emotional issue. So that, the economy would have to go down very far, very fast for him to lose a lot of his base support.
What's your number right now? I mean, CBO, I guess we're due for another renumber, but are we at 1.3 or 1.4 trillion out there at some point?
You mean for a deficit?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, look, we're probably going to hit, we'll hit 1.1 trillion in 2019. Maybe a little bit higher if we get a space force and a $25 billion for the wall and God knows what else for infrastructure. But CBO is saying that it's only going to go up from there, not down. And if there's an economic downturn, Tom, even a mild downturn, we're talking about a deficit that will approach $2 trillion easily. Wow. That'll be a combination of 1.1, 1.2 permanent deficits and about $800 billion in cyclical changes.
So this is the first I've ever heard this, Pim. Are you willing to say the $2 trillion number, given some form of migration of GDP south? GDP comes in under 2%, Stan?
Were we 4.2%
now? And that's how you get the $2 trillion?
Well, Tom, we're at 4.2 trillion, Pim, 4.2% last quarter.
Quarter, right.
So it's not clear that it's going to be in fact, it's very clear that it's not going to be a long-term trend. But Tom, if you look at the CBO numbers, they have the economy growing at less than 2%.
Yeah.
And that's the point at which you start to get, deficits of $1.5, $1.6 trillion.
So to be clear here, when we get under 2 point what? Do we begin to see that incremental deficit add-on?
Well, it depends on what you're assuming. We're assuming about a 3% growth rate, or the administration's assuming about a 3% growth rate. Once you start getting below that, the deficit gets higher than you were projecting. At below 2%, you get the numbers that CBO was looking at.
Stan, thank you so much. Stan Colander, the budget guy. Of course, writing for Forbes, piercing short articles for Forbes that really cut through all the blab. Joining us now within the morning chaos of moving to Canada and moving on to the tweets of the day is Andy Hunt with Wells Fargo. Andy, have you tweeted this morning? Have you had anything about cross asset policy in your tweet stream this morning?
Sadly, no. I'm not active.
You have an exceptionally sophisticated chart leading off your research note on Jensen's alpha, which I'm going to guess is some form of relative performance. Where is the best value now on a relative basis within the markets?
So we still like U.S. credit, though less maybe than we have in times recently past, and the consumer, the state of the U.S. economy, the fundamentals are very strong, and technicals are still positive with relatively little issuance coming in some parts of the market. So we still see still value in the U.S. credit sector.
Within this, is at some point it will end. Within fixed income, what signs do you look for where you say price up and yield lower is going to end? What are the signals that you look for, Mr. Hunt?
So, interesting question. There is some signs of late cycle behavior. I mean, people ask, where are we at in the economic and credit cycle, and what innings are we in? And I do kind of happily say we're in the eighth or ninth innings, but happily to suggest it might be a 10 or 11 innings match. But we are getting there late in the cycle, and there is some late cycle behavior appearing in some parts, particularly, I would say, in the U.S. loan market, where we see many of the protections and the indentures that are weakening, the covenants are lightening, and that's on a number of fronts. But that's this maybe an early warning sign. Happily to say, though, that we think many of the signals that some people are pointing to don't suggest an imminent recession or imminent problem. We might be 2 or 3 years out from a worry state.
Andy Hunt, it is not a new Netflix original. It is not a new movie. What is Jensen's Alpha? And why is that something we need to learn about?
So it's a measure of risk-adjusted value add or risk-adjusted return. So it's a way of adjusting for a portfolio's beta and then seeing what alpha is left over. So it's kind of a fancy way of just saying outperformance or genuine outperformance after beta adjusting the performance stream.
And are people trying to outperform in a market that is just not going to help them? When you've got the NASDAQ up more than 17%, and the S&P 500 approaching a 9% return this year?
So everyone's always trying to outperform. The question is, where is it easier or harder to outperform? And my chart you're referring to centers around the fixed income markets primarily. And it was a research piece we did, which was just trying to ask ourselves the question whether passive mandates were going to make great inroads into the fixed income management landscape. As we've seen in the equity markets, 40%+ of money is now invested passively in equity. And I saw a stat to say that around 20% of fixed income markets were passively invested. And so the question was, can active managers justify their existence by continuing to provide risk-adjusted outperformance?
Andy Hunt, Pim Fox asked a really, really sophisticated question about the three differentials of Trainer, Jensen, and Sharpe. And I thought your answer was great on Jensen Alpha, but what this really comes down to is the study of beta and the study of relative performance within an individual security or a portfolio. And here's the critical question for Global Wall Street and everybody else as well. Does that mathematics and dynamics still work in a time of ETFs, bundled products, and index funds?
I think so, because essentially, what you're getting with an ETF, if it's a good one and if it performs as you hope it does, you kind of get what you buy, which is the market beta. And then the question is, well, what's left over? You either allocate between ETFs and add value by sector selection, asset allocation, or you try and beat the ETFs at their game, which is getting better access to the part of the market that you're trying to target. And so I think these measures, risk-adjusted performance or alpha-type scores, are very relevant because alpha is an uncorrelated form of return if it's done well, and it's almost like another risk premium to harness if you can find parts of the market which are inefficient that you can find a better access point than a passive ETF. And so that's the purpose of this trainer ratio analysis, was to substantiate that many parts of the fixed income market do show evidence of inefficiencies and therefore consistent opportunity for alpha.
What does active management need to do in bonds to take the high ground back from index funds? Is there an Andy Hunt to-do list on what needs to be done besides simple security selection, bond selection?
Yeah, is it like things like private debt?
Andy, you got to understand our sophistication. On Pim Fox's desk is the E.F. Hutton Blue S&P bond book from 1963?
Yeah, 64.
64 or something. Yeah. I mean, that's the level of sophistication here. So.
I'm sure you're selling yourself way short. Yes is the answer. I think the fixed income indices and therefore ETFs that center on them or passive managers that focus on them are not that great. That's a sweeping statement and I'm sure people will criticize me for it, but I think there's plenty of room for improvement. We've seen a lot so as well as traditional active management in fixed income, which I think is alive well and has a very vibrant future, I think there's a middle ground where we've seen in the equity space a lot of so-called smart beta initiatives and work done, a lot of research around factors and rewarded risk factors within equity. We've seen size, momentum, low vol. Those types of concepts need to wash across to fixed income and also become embedded in the vernacular, in the taxonomy of products. So you have plain, traditional, passive against standard market benchmarks, the market issuance, market cap style benchmarks we all know and love and have kind of blindly invested in for years. You've had active managers against them, and then in between, I think you'll see this growth of a smart beta future where we'll have the rewarded risk factors, the better benchmark constructions created to give, again, more efficient access to what really you're trying to get, which is efficient yield, characteristics such as duration that you want, but broad-based yield from diverse income sources that then you generate that reliable income stream that frankly bond investors wish for.
Andy Hunt, if you have to choose between purchasing loans in order to get the yield or high yield bonds, where does Andy Hunt recommend you put the money? Loans or high yield bonds?
We have, two answers to that. I would say in the States we go for bonds over loans, but out of Europe we might turn that around and say loans over bonds.
Why is that?
The different players in the market and the different recent history of the market, the oil energy market crisis of a couple, 3 years ago, kind of taught the bond market, kept the bond market honest and gave it some discipline. And we see good issuance, good indentures, good behaviors, and without excess leverage or excess supply coming in the bond market. Whereas in the States, the loan market is being fed by an awful lot of sort of issuance for CLO use, and we see weakening covenants, and we worry that implies a problem around the corner.
Yeah.
Obviously, loans prepay at will, and therefore you don't get all the upside if things go well. But if things go badly, you sit with a spread widening instrument, and it's not fun. In Europe, the nature of the beast is a little different. They didn't have the oil energy problem. Therefore, kind of the market didn't sort of have that wake-up call a couple, 3 years ago in the bond market. And on the loan market, because of the nature of the beast, again, you don't have the rules around UCITS funds particularly, which is the mutual fund equivalent in Europe. They don't permit loans-only UCITS funds. It's just the regs don't allow it.
Right.
And therefore, it kept the retail investor out of the loans market, and so it's more of an institutional market, and it's kept its
interesting
quality better.
This has been wonderful. Andy Hunt, thank you so much with Wells Fargo. Just thrilled to have you on today. He is co-head at their global fixed income and head of loan and global credit. He went to Milton Academy, where the entire hockey team was Canadian. Then he went to Yale University, where he ate at every Mexican restaurant, alternating with pizza. We welcome Austin Goolsbee, the former chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors. He holds court in the land of the Chicago Cubs and the Chicago White Sox, and we welcome him this morning. Austin, on the complexities of trade, which come down to political simplicity, what are you listening for in this argument between Canada and the United States, in this separate argument of Mexico in the United States? What has your attention?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me back again, Tom. What has my attention, I guess, is whether it remains what it is now, which I would characterize as a bunch of minor, small stuff. And that makes me feel better. Any day that we don't have a trade war is a good day for the economy. And so if we want to argue about should we put in some little provision that applies to one sector or one thing or something, and they can agree on that, and by agreeing on that they don't engage in a full-blown trade war, then that's great. So I don't anticipate, I guess my prediction is that Canada wouldn't have too much problem with the things that the U.S. and Mexico agreed to, because they were a bunch of small things, and they seemed less significant than what Canada had already agreed to for the TPP, which was thrown out. So I would think that we could get to a deal pretty quickly.
Right. To give President Obama and President Trump credit, they're dealing in a different world than the world of GATT, of Uruguay, of what we did out of World War II and onward in trade. In this modern trade debate, what does President Trump get right?
Look, I have made no secret. I don't think he's getting much right. I think President Trump has in his mind a zero-sum world in which there are only winners and losers. We can't do anything that makes us both better off. And I think the emphasis on bilateral deals rather than building robust institutions for the whole world, I think that's a mistake. So I don't know that on trade Donald Trump's getting a lot right. I guess I would say that one thing that he's getting right, he's not the first to discover it, is that there are non-tariff barriers and non-tariff things going on in the world of trade that do matter, like that the Chinese take the intellectual property. They force people that invest in China to turn over their blueprints and hand over their technology. He's getting that right. I just disagree with how he's trying to address that, but I do think he's diagnosed that problem right.
Austin Goolsbee, is the World Trade Organization an effective forum for mitigating or remediating trade problems between nations? Does it work?
Yeah, mostly it has worked. If the United States tries to blow it up, it's definitely not going to work anymore because we're one of the linchpins of it. I can tell you my view of what's good and what's bad about the WTO. What's
Go ahead.
Good is far more important than what's bad, and what's good is it's an institution that allows not objective but kind of an objective view that all the countries that participate agree we will treat each other with at least this much respect. You can't put specific tariffs on a WTO country. They have to be treated as a most favored nation status. To sign up for WTO, you have to agree to abide by certain conventions, and if you don't, you can be called to account. The U.S. has benefited significantly, filing WTO grievances, receiving compensation, or forcing countries to stop their protectionist stuff against the United States. The what's been wrong with the WTO, or what's proved hard as the decades have gone on, is there are countries, most especially China, which joined the WTO as a small emerging market, which they kind of give small, poor countries more latitude than big, developed economies. So China got in and follows the rules of a small, emerging market, and now they're the second biggest economy in the world. So it's an uncomfortable fit of how that of how they're treated. But overall, the WTO has been far, far more beneficial to the U.S. Right. economy as well as to the world than what its problems have been. I mean, there's no doubt about that.
Professor Goolsbee, thank you so much. This has been incredibly well
timed. Yeah, great talking to you guys again.
Austin Goolsbee, thank you so much, with the Booth School of Chicago, former chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.